In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. All right, who saw the Oscars last Sunday?
Not me.
Neither did I. But you heard about it, right? You heard what happened, right? The fiasco at the end where Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway get up there to present the Best Picture Award, and they read the wrong card so that all the people from La La Land get up out of the seats and get, oh, we did it 14 in a row, right? And they get up there and they receive the award, and then the guys with the headsets run out and go, it's the wrong one. And then, after several minutes later, they finally discover, oh, no, Moonlight should have won. And so the director from La La Land says, sorry, Moonlight, come on up. So big fiasco, everything's fine. Nobody remembers, but it happened. Faye Dunaway, Warren Beatty, right? 30 years ago this month, Faye Dunaway was in another sort of moment of interest, worth noting. She had just won the Oscar for Best Actress in a film called Network. She beat out Talia Shire as Adrian in Rocky. Adrian, I'm a lover, not a fighter, right? And then also Sissy Spacek as Carrie, which I will not try to replicate. But she wins all of that. She's Rocky won Best Picture that year, though. They ran the table, but for Best Picture. Network wins. She's up there. She receives the award. And then the next day, this. It's the day after she wins the Oscar for Best Actress. It tried to curb your enthusiasm, Faye, right? What's going on there? Like, here's all of the newspapers documenting the accolades, strewn on the ground like it's wrapping paper. Like, that's stuff you throw away. And then there's the Oscar sitting there prominently on the table outside the Beverly Hills Hotel. But most importantly, there's Faye Dunaway looking at it like a... Yeah, meh, right? Sort of remarkable, right? Here's this actress that, because she wins this award, is indicative of having reached the pinnacle of her craft, the pinnacle of admiration from her peers and everybody that likes that, and she's kind of like, yeah, wow. And I don't think this is just because the after-party fatigue. I think this is more like, and what was all that for? Like, all the adrenaline of, like, maybe I'll win, and now she won, and now, anticipating, Sally Field, you like me, you really like me. And now she sits there going, yeah. I think not only is this sort of an iconic picture, I think it's indicative of something about what's at the deep parts of life. I think what she reflects in this very candid photo is something true about how we tend to think about what it means, in the words of Walt Whitman, to suck the marrow out of life. Faye Dunaway is showing us one way of thinking about it, but she's now perhaps revising her thinking about it. And I think she's actually saying something to us that's important about how we think of what life is and how we would suck the marrow out of life. On Ash Wednesday a few days ago, we began looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. And on Wednesday, we listened to what we've called the patron of the preacher of Ecclesiastes. There are two voices in Ecclesiastes. There's the one who's the most prominent that you'll hear for the most of the book of Ecclesiastes, but there's also an editor, a patron, a compiler that has brought to us the preacher's words, and which he comments on at the very beginning and the very end of the book. We heard from him on Wednesday. Today, we begin to hear from the words of the preacher himself. If the preacher were alive, I think he'd cut out this picture and put it in his journal and say, yep, take heed, you who follow God. There's something here for you to simmer on. We're going to listen to his quest and what he learned to how to suck the marrow out of life and what he has for us in that. It's a long passage. I will leave it to your discretion whether or not you want to stand. If you want to, you can. If you don't, feel free to sit. But we're going to read the preacher's words starting in chapter 1, verse 12, and go all the way to the end of chapter 2. So if you want to stand, stand. Cody, don't get up. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, starting in verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after a wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I said in my heart, come now. I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. And also my wisdom remained with me. And whatever my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. And then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet, I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. And then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he'll be wise or a fool. Yet he will be a master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat? Or who can have enjoyment? For the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving after wind. Brothers and sisters, this is the word of the Lord given to us in love. You may be seated. Why does somebody take a picture like this of Faye Dunaway? Like, what's the point of that, right? We know it's in part because she's part of that contingent that we call celebrity. But why is there such thing as celebrity? Why have we come to celebrate those whose primary function in this life is to pretend being somebody else? Now, some might argue that at least in this country, celebrities are the closest thing to royalty that we have in this country. I mean, presidents don't command the same Oh, wait a minute. You have a pencil? Let me write that up. For the most part, celebrities, for many, inhabit a space that floats above the rest of the world, right? That's why we like them. And that's why many, for so long, will track every single movement of people like Faye Dunaway. From every move, from every surgery, from everything. They'll do it all. The person at the center of the book of Ecclesiastes, whom the narrator calls the preacher, you caught it there, he associates himself with a king, a son of David. Tradition has held that that author is Solomon. Might be. If you press linguistically into the nature of the language, it appears more so that the book originated much later than King Solomon. And if that's the case, you have to ask yourself, why is the person who's writing this assuming the persona of a king? In some reasons, it's the same reason why there are such things as pseudonymous authors. Why do some people write under a pen name? Because they want you to take stock more of what they're saying than of who they are. And that their identity, if you really knew who they were, would be a distraction from what you heard, and you would read everything that they say through a certain set of lenses. This author is assuming the persona of a king to make a point. And you might think that that point is to bring to themselves a certain level of aggrandizement, of assuming a persona that you might think better of them or think more highly of them. And you could think that, you could accuse them of that, except when this person puts on the persona of a king, everything he says thereafter undermines his authority as being anybody but wise, as being anything but great. No king talks about despair, brothers and sisters, but this one does. And in doing so, he's out to make a point. The patron of the preacher, the editor of this book, whom we introduced to you on Wednesday, he summarizes the thesis of this preacher. But if you were listening closely in verses 13 and 14, the preacher reiterates that thesis. Listen again. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that is done under the sun. Behold, it's all vanity, striving after the wind. If you were with us Wednesday, then you heard that that word for vanity is the Hebrew word hevel. It's literally translated smoke. Based upon all the translations out there, the one I think that most captures the sense of that word hevel is the word absurdity. That the more you press into the reality of things, the more you discover it's just ridiculous. It's just ridiculous. It portrays itself in ways that if you were to really think about it, you realize it's not what you think it is. It doesn't mean everything that you hoped it would. Everything is an absurdity. It's utterly ridiculous. And that's why I think the best scene in cinema that typifies what the book of Ecclesiastes is the last scene in The Bridge on the River Kwai. The train falls over on the bridge that's just exploded. The British officers that helped put that bridge together are looking at themselves going, why did we do that? The British commandant, led by Sir Alec Guinness, realizes that he has been living under an illusion that to be good English gentlemen meant to help and aid and abet the enemy. And then with his dying breath, he's been shot. He falls upon the TNT that blows up the bridge. The train falls. The CIA agents that came in are all dead. And one British officer looks over the whole range and says two words, madness. Madness. That's what the author of Ecclesiastes is saying when he looks on the world. He says, madness. And we think and look at him and we go, dude, are you sure? Lighten up. And then he says to us, grab a chair, sit a spell. Let me tell you a story. Let me tell you the story of my life. And then he shares with us his quests. And to be a king means you have a certain measure of resources available to you that allows you to go to the nines, to fill things out, to pursue every dream you have. If you're a pauper, you only got so much time and resources on your hands to discover the meaning of life. But if you've got everything at your disposal like a king does, it's a different kind of world. It's a different kind of opportunity. And he goes on quest because he has the means to get there. And what does he learn? He learns, first of all, by questing after pleasure to get everything that he might delight himself in. He delights himself with food and drink. He builds, he plants, he cultivates, he buys servants, he accrues possessions, he secures the pleasures of the opposite sex, and because he likes to keep score, he claims supremacy over all his peers. There's no limit to his pursuit. And at the conclusion of that pursuit of pleasure, what is his conclusion? Verse 2, it's mad. Verse 11, it's vanity. You might as well be chasing wind. If you're going after pleasure to suck the marrow out of life, he is saying you are only setting yourself up for a profound pratfall. You only have to go so far as the kings of Israel to prove that you can have everything you want and still it not be enough for you. Just consider King David. It was out of his dissatisfaction that he let his indulgence lead to his own personal disaster. Just think about King Solomon. It's his own dissatisfaction that leads him to an indulgence in a variety of ways that leads to the very downfall of the kingdom of Israel. The getting and the having for them and for everybody that's come after them and everybody that's come before him. It's no true meaning. Is there any delight in it? Absolutely. People wouldn't do it if there wasn't something in it. But like we said Wednesday night, the feeling fades. Nothing changes. Nothing sticks. Nothing lasts. The Danish philosopher Søren Kierkegaard explained how the problem with the life of pleasure is that it requires that you have a short-term memory. There's a word for the kind of person that the preacher's embodying in some of the writings of Soren Kierkegaard. He talks about somebody he calls the aesthete, which doesn't just mean somebody that likes the aesthetic world or arts. It's sort of a broader, more arcane way of putting it. It's the idea of somebody who is out to indulge everything they can. That's the aesthete in Kierkegaard's world. But to live that life means at some point, to live like that means at some point you have to start forgetting how every time you delight in something that it starts to fade. And you begin to wonder, why am I doing this? Only by cutting yourself off from your memory can you cut yourself off from the idea of the law of diminishing returns. The life of pleasure, therefore, is an impossibility when trying to suck the marrow out of life. It's just not there. And if you were listening closely to how the preacher puts things, part of his delight had less to do with the objects of desire themselves and more so with having more delight, more assets, more power than all his peers. Later in the book of Ecclesiastes, he's going to talk about the absurdity about how men are motivated mostly by envy of their neighbor. They don't want it for wanting it. They want it because, oh, wow, they got better seats than I did. I wish I had that. If only I had that, I'd be happy. The life of personal fulfillment through delight is too often tinged with who has the most. And the preacher is not subtle in that quest for delight, which means his quest had a lot to do with his own glorification, with his own promotion. And it's a phenomenon that's repeated in every age across all manner of people. Where it crops up, it always is evidence of a gain, not just a gain that you think is a gain that is ephemeral. It's actually an evidence of a tragedy. On the front of your bulletin, there's a guy named Anthony DeMello who said this. It's the second quote on the front of your bulletin. He says, "Attempt to understand the true nature of worldly feelings, namely the feelings of self-promotion, self-glorification. They're not natural. They were invented by your society and your culture to make you productive and to make you comfortable. These feelings do not produce the nourishment and happiness that is produced when one contemplates nature or enjoys the company of one's friends or one's work. They were meant to produce thrills and excitement and emptiness. The attempt to get full turns out to be an excursion into emptiness. What does it profit a man, Jesus says, to gain the whole world and yet lose his own soul? The preacher, Soren Kierkegaard, and Jesus were all in lockstep. And we say, and the preacher says, fine, okay, pleasure, that ain't where it's at. What about something else? Yeah, okay, pleasure leads to a pratfall, fine. What about wisdom? What about perfectly aligning yourself with the nature of reality? And so, to find the marrow of life, he looks to wisdom. Chapter 2, verse 12. So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. He takes stock of all the wisdom available to him, the way of thinking and speaking and responding at the right time, in the right way, for the right purpose, with the right attitude, for the right motivation. That's wisdom. He also looks into people stuff do that's totally motivated by folly. Because, look, there's a lot of people doing foolish things out there, but they wouldn't be doing it unless there was a certain attraction to it. So he studies that too. What does he learn? In a sense, he says, wisdom beats folly hands down. If you go to the gas pump to fill up your car, and if you have to choose between smoking a cigarette and not, you know where wisdom calls for, right? It means that you don't. Now, that's a far less exciting way of pumping gas. But at least you know that you will still have ears upon which to hang your glasses. Because that's wisdom. And the preacher is wise enough to know wise choices are preferable to foolish ones. But before you sign the book deal on wisdom, he says, just consider, you might have the good sense not to light up a cigarette at the gas pump. But you know what? The guy one pump over in the beat up Camaro who's looking on his smartphone, checking the scores for WWE the night before, if he flicks out the ashes, you're both going to need an obituary next week. And the only difference between you and him is that your obit might be written in complete sentences. What? Thank you very much. I'll be here all week. Cold comfort, right? Oh, you're wise. Great. You're still dead. What happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? The preacher asks himself. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. If you think wisdom will rescue you from death, you're wrong. And if you think being brilliant and the person that everybody calls on when they need counsel is enough to guarantee that you'll be remembered, even if that were the case, who cares? You're dead. Pleasure makes for a pratfall, but wisdom, he says, wisdom always ends in a wake. There's no getting around it. Okay, fine, he says. Pleasure? All right. Marked off. Wisdom? Ugh, marked off. What about the fruit of my labor? I know, I'll just work very hard and benefit from the fruit of my labor. You will unleash the power within. You will have a date with destiny. You will master life and wealth. These are all titles of Tony Robbins seminars. Right? The preacher sought all of that. And what are his conclusions? You can work hard, you can work well, you can be efficient, but you can work until you're almost dead and create a very impressive list of accomplishments that you can put on a piece of paper that we use big Latin words like curriculum vitae. But all that effort will not be without a cost to you because it will cost you sleepless nights. And you will push your body and mind beyond its limits and potentially become a real tyrant, if not to yourself, but to everybody else you know. J. Paul Getty, founder of Getty Oil. Hugh, does Getty Oil still even exist? No, sorry. See? Quod erat demonstrandum. J. Paul Getty, Getty Oil, 20th century. One of those people that you'd call one of the one percenters, right? Founders of Getty Oil. Vast empire. Forms a vast empire, but loses a family. Two of his kids get strung out on drugs. One of them overdoses. He has multiple marriages. This is what J. Paul Getty said at the end of his life. A lasting relationship with a woman is only possible if you're a business failure. And I hate to be a failure. I hate and regret the failure of my marriages.
I would gladly give all my millions for just one lasting marital success. Do you hear the contradiction in two sentences? Do you hear how the pursuit of toil can twist the mind into thinking it's a zero-sum game between faithfulness to a career or faithfulness to another human being? That's what he really thought. And obviously, that's what he really thought. And for reasons that alone, the preacher says, it ain't worth it. But his larger discovery, that even if it goes well for you and you build this massive empire, for one, you have to leave it all behind. And so you have to just ask yourself, now what was, remind me of that, what that was for. And then secondly, who you leave it to may not have the slightest interest or aptitude to continue what began. For example, J. Paul Getty. Paul Kalanithi, remember his name? We read his words on Christmas Day. Brilliant neurosurgeon. Diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Never smoked a day in his life. Leaves behind a 2-year-old daughter and a wife. Wrote a book called When Breath Becomes Air. You should read it. He said this, "Everyone succumbs to finitude. Most ambitions are either achieved or abandoned. Either way, they belong to the past. The future, instead of the latter toward the goals of life, flattens out into a perpetual present. Money, status, all the vanities the preacher of Ecclesiastes described hold so little interest. A chasing after wind indeed." So there you have it, friends. Pleasure, wisdom, fruit of your labor. All great things. They're not a waste of time. But they're just not what you think they are a lot of the time. Samuel Johnson, who is the third quote on the front of your bulletin, says this, "Such is the condition of life that something is always wanting to happiness. In youth, we have warm hopes which are soon blasted by rashness and negligence and great designs which are defeated by inexperience. But in age, we have knowledge and prudence without spirit to exert or motives to prompt them. We are able to plan schemes and regulate measures, but have not time remaining to bring them to completion." That's our lot in life. That's your lot in life. What is all that meant to tell us? What is the preacher out to disabuse us of as it relates to the series that we're considering during Lent? It's this. If you make what happens in life be the ultimate measure of life, you imperil yourself for life. Let me say it again. That's thick, I know. Track the prepositions. If you make what happens in life be the ultimate measure of life, you imperil yourself for life. If you allow what happens under the sun to be the determinant of your day in the sun, you are only going to wither under the heat of the sun. For the preacher, he was looking for his Oscar in wisdom, in pleasure, in the fruit of his labor. And with every quest came the Monday morning languished post near the pool at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Whatever your version of your Oscar is, whatever you might be spending decades out to obtain, if that's your goal, if that's where all your energies are directed, then you are asking, if not guaranteeing, this same sort of that Faye Dunaway has. If you put this passage before Faye Dunaway today, I bet you she'd nod her head. But you know who also might nod their approval and listen to what the preacher says? The Lord Jesus would. Why would I say that? Because a lot of what the preacher says, you go, whoa, Jesus and him got to have a sit down and he's going to have a come to Jesus moment. How do they align? I'm about to say more or less what I said Wednesday night, but just a different nuance. If you and I just consider the cross of Jesus, if you just consider the table that we're about to come to in a moment, what it means to us about our need and our desperation, which Seamus and Savannah just acknowledged in joining this church, if you just consider that, then does not that challenge any notion that any pleasure you find, any wisdom you gain, any toil you transact can ever really be a substitute for what the cross has done for you? Are any of us secretly believing that if we just enjoy ourselves enough, or we're just brilliant enough, or we just create enough, that any or all of that could really be a substitute for what we're about to partake of? At the same time that Jesus is crying out on his cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's also saying, listen to the preacher. If you think that you might obtain or accomplish anything under the sun, and that whatever you do under the sun will be a replacement for what I am doing for you under the heat of God's wrath, you are foolish. Jesus would agree with the preacher that there is a limit to what you will find in seeking pleasure or obtaining wisdom or in working for the fruit of your labor. And that is how it's always been. So what's the solution? I mean, right now it's kind of like, looks like we do nothing. No, it's just a different kind of something. The solution is not to give up on living. Or even to look like what we can get in this life is at best a flimsy return. We don't give up on living. We do give up on living in order to get a life. We give up on living in order to create a life, or to think that we can create a life, and instead we learn to live on the basis of a life we've already been given. The cross, this table, is saying to us, there is no life you can carve out for yourself that will ever be a substitute for what he is doing on our behalf. But at the same time, the cross is accomplishing for us a life from which all living might at last be true. Let me see if I can put that in very simplest terms. There are two kinds of kids in this world. There are kids who are living desperately for the love and approval of their parents. They believe hold out that approval like a carrot on a stick. And they either spend their whole lives trying to get it, or they rebel against it because they don't think they're ever going to get it. There's that one kind of kid. And then there's another kind of kid who already believes that mom and dad love them, cherish them, no matter what. And if you think for a minute that those aren't vastly different ways of living, you aren't thinking. Everything starts there. And children live out that world forever. And the extent to which I am living in the way of the former way for my children is the extent to which I must reform my ways, that they might know that I love them and cherish them no matter what. What this table is telling you is that there is nothing you could do to merit his love. What this table is telling you and me is that love is already very secure, and all you must do is rest in that, and from that, live. You can't live up to that, but you can live out of that. That's what the cross tells us. That's what this table tells us. And that's why it's a good day to have a meal with the host of this table.